Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I'm your host, Ari Barblatt. I am honored and blessed to be in dialogue today with Dr. Barak Cohen. He is a senior lecturer of Talmudic literature at Bar-Ilan University. We are here today to discuss his book, The Legal Methodology of Late Nehardean Sages in Sassanian Babylonia, published by Brill Publishers, 2011. Barak, it's an honor to be in dialogue with you today.
It's nice to be here. Thanks for inviting.
Thank you. To begin, can you kindly tell us about yourself? Where did your enthusiasm for the study of Talmud come from? Where did you grow up? How did your interest in the study of Talmud lead you to this topic? Were there any formative events in your life that led you to this field and to this particular area of research?
During the 90s, I learned at Yeshivat Bnei Akiva in Kfar Aroe, and then after finishing my high school, I went straight into KBY, Kerem Beyavne Yeshiva. Came over to Bar-Ilan University. My original plan was to study medicine, and I used to volunteer on the intensive care units in Magen David Adom in Israel. And while studying at Bar-Ilan University for my first degree, I had a very, very interesting and great Talmid Chacham, professor of Talmudic literature. His name was Professor Meir Simcha Feldblum from Yeshiva University. And when I studied in his classes, which were then compulsory courses, it was so interesting that I couldn't, I'll put it this way, I knew that this would be the field that I wanted to do the rest of my life. And he never left me. He did everything he could in order to have me as a master's student for my thesis. And then he was my advisor for my PhD studies and so on. And this is how I got here.
What are the primary themes in this book? What message does this book convey?
The book itself is trying to analyze the way the rabbis in late antiquity, how they thought, how they ruled, and how they interpreted earlier sources. That's the main idea of the entire book.
What would you like listeners to get out of our dialogue today?
I want them to try and to understand how important is to understand the way the sages in late antiquity ruled in daily life. Because you know that nowadays, the Talmud is the Babylonian Talmud, mainly the Babylonian Talmud, is considered as a canonical text. This is the basis for many of the poske halakha, many rulers in Middle Ages, and even nowadays, many, many rabbis in their drashot, public ceremonies and so on, use the Talmud and the Talmudic literature in general to explain many theological opinions, many theological halachic rulings and so on. And they use the Talmud to apply it to daily life.
How reliable are the traditions pertaining to the rabbis that you examine in this book? What debates about their reliability exist? How do you ascertain their reliability as a researcher and a scholar?
There are many, many scholars who are very skeptical about the reliability of attributions in the Babylonian Talmud. What's the meaning of being skeptical? The meaning of this is the question whether, if we have, for instance, a tradition attributed to one of the sages in Babylonia or in Eretz Israel, in Palestine, are they indeed reliable? Could we count on them as reliable sources or stories about the sages? Did they really say what was attributed to them? More and more scholars or studies in recent years indeed show us that one should be indeed skeptical about many of the traditions. However, one should never generalize and say that the entire Talmud is a late editorial work and the traditions were attributed in a fictional way to earlier sages. In other words, many studies show in recent years that indeed many, or I wouldn't say most of them, but many of them are indeed reliable sources, and we can count on these sources as reliable and attributed to the name of the sages in Palestine or in Babylonia.
How has your own thinking changed and evolved? How has this book been received by different audiences?
Because in modern research, that we believe that the scientific study of the Talmud, when we try to understand the sages and what they said in the world of the sages, the Talmud should be interpreted according to its historical context and not according to the late reasoning of each rabbi. One should not interpret the Talmud from a later period to the earlier period. This allows us to understand the basis of many controversies in the Talmud itself. In other words, many scholars nowadays, specifically from the late 5 or 6 years, understood that in order to interpret a specific ruling or interpretation of an Amora, you must go back and try to analyze the reasoning by understanding his legal methodology. This allows us to interpret any specific case attributed to that sage based on his own way of thinking and reasoning in many, many Babylonian Sugyot and their parallels also in the Palestinian Talmud. This is the way I believe we should interpret the Talmud itself. And many scholars, such as Professor Robert Brody from Hebrew University, who's published a book on tractate Ketubot just 2-3 months ago, quotes this book and even argues that the next stage of Talmudic research must be based on the legal of analysis of the legal methodology of the Babylonian Amoraim.
For the benefit of our listeners who might not have background in Talmud, can you explain the meanings of the terms Tanaim, Amoraim, Savoraim, and Stamaim?
Okay, let's see. Let's begin with the Tanaim. Tanaim are sages who lived mainly in Palestine between the destruction of the Second Temple period, meaning the year 70 AD, to the year 200 or 220 in Palestine. We know of certain very, very few Tanaim or sages who lived during this Tanaitic period in Babylonia as well. But I would say it is a very, very difficult topic, and we still are not sure how many Tanaim were active during the Tanaitic period in Babylonia. That's a very, very difficult topic. In any case, a Tana is mainly from Palestine, and they are sages who lived between 70 and 200 or 220, the days of the reduction of the Mishnah by Rabbi Yehuda the prince. Amora is a sage who lived in Palestine or in Babylonia after the death, one generation after the death of Rabbi Judah the prince in Palestine, between, let's say, 230 AD to the year in Palestine to the year of 400, or a bit earlier, maybe 370, 400. And in Babylonia, the Amoraic period ends in the year 500. Saboraim, or Savoraim in Hebrew, are sages who lived in Babylonia after the Amoraic period, mainly from the year 500 to 590, maybe even 600. And according to other views, in the Geonic period, according to testimonies from the Geonim, it might be that they lived even to the very, very close to the year 700 in Babylonia. So these are the main terms dealing with the sages themselves, Tanaim, and then we have Amoraim. Mishnah is the legal text redacted by Rabbi Judah the Prince before his death in about 280, and the Baraitot, meaning outside traditions, the traditions that were left outside the Mishnah during the reductional process by Rabbi Judah the Prince, were all collected by his students and that's the reason, and they were all collected to the Tosefta. Tosefta is additional Tanaitic traditions to the Mishnah in very, very basic terms. So we know what is the Mishnah, the legal text redacted by Rabbi Judah the Prince, and then we know that the Tosefta is also the meaning which has in it the main traditions, legal traditions outside the Mishnah, left by outside by Rabbi Judah the Prince, and Baraita, meaning Bar, an outside tradition, left outside by Rabbi Judah.
Can you tell us about the history of scholarship on this topic?
Many scholars, such as Solomon Fuchs from the end of the 19th century in Berlin, in his book, Die Juden in Babylonia, in German, and scholars such as Meir Dov Yudilovich and Ze'ev Yavetz, and many, many other scholars thought that since Nehardea was a very, very ancient town, since we know the existence of Jewish communities in the city of Nehardea, northern part of Babylonia, Iraq, nowadays Iraq, since we know of the existence of Jewish communities in the end of the Second Temple period, so many scholars thought or believe that Nehardea has many, many Jewish ancient traditions from earlier times. And therefore, I took this as a test case. I tried to analyze the main legal traditions attributed to sages in Nehardea, and I went and tried to look for earlier traditions attributed to the sages. And to my surprise, I was really amazed to find out that many of these traditions have no earlier roots in Babylonia or in Palestine. Many of them were created by Babylonian sages during the 4th and beginning of 5th centuries. And this shows us how the halakha was developing from Tanaitic Palestinian halakha to Babylonian halakha. Also, I should add that many of these traditions, halakhic traditions, were also created in the Sasanian realia, meaning that many of these traditions, rulings and legal rulings and interpretations were based on the legal Sasanian system in Babylonia and not on earlier Jewish roots or on Palestinian roots in Palestine. This was already mentioned by Professor Yaakov Elman in his many, many of his studies dealing with the comparative research of Sasanian and Jewish law in the Talmudic period.
How does contemporary scholarship on legal realism in the field of law factor into your analysis? In what ways do the figures that you examine in this book complement such perspectives? In what ways do the sages that you analyze in this book contradict or challenge or complement legal realism as it is understood in contemporary studies in legal theory.
I'll give you an example. We know of a very, very interesting sage, very bold personality. His name of this sage's name was Amema, and he lived from the end of the 4th century, and he died in the beginning of the 5th century. I would say that analysis of his entire corpus of traditions in the Babylonian Talmud, more than 200 traditions, show us that this sage, legal reasoning, legal interpretations, and so on, is what we know of legal realism in legal philosophy. And you know that many rabbis nowadays keep claiming that the halakha never changes. In other words, the halakha mentioned in the Bible or in the Mishnah, Tanaitic literature, and so on, never changes according to the realia, different realities in different times. And when you analyze Amemar's traditions, you see exactly the opposite. You see how many of the laws were rejected by Amemar and they were adopted to change in daily life. In many cases, for instance, he either rejected explicitly the halakha in the Mishnah because he claimed that this specific halakha should be applied only in Palestine in the Tanaitic period, but in Babylonian realia, it should be changed. He was very, very bold in his, not only his personality, but also in his legal rulings. And many, many rabbis, Talmudic interpreters, such as Rabbi Menachem HaMeiri, in his book, Bet HaBchira, and so on, were astonished by these rulings because the Meiri claims that if you do so, if you go according to Amemar's rulings, the Mishnah or the earlier halakha has no meaning because according to Amemar, according to his interpretations, many of these world rulings are not relevant to daily life in his specific time. And when you compare it to nowadays, ultra-Orthodox rabbis, you see that ultra-Orthodox legal rulings by famous rabbis, I'm not sure that they're correct by saying that halakha is never subject to change, but I don't think this is indeed the case. The more you learn about the Talmud, which is the basic for Jewish life nowadays, you see how the halakha was very different from what we know of or from what the rabbis nowadays in contemporary society, ultra-Orthodox rabbis, how they interpret the Talmud and the halakha.
Where was Nehardea located? Can you describe its social and physical geography? Can you describe the history of its destruction?
Nehardea was situated in the northern part of Iraq on the Euphrates River, and it was about between 20 to 30 kilometers south of the great city of Pumbedita. Pumbedita is very close to the city, the great Muslim Shiite city nowadays, which is known as Al-Fallujah. Very, very big city. And Nehardea is identified with a small, small village known as nowadays as Tal Nihar. This is based on Professor Aaron Oppenheimer's book, Jewish Babylonia in the Talmudic Period. He does the geography of the entire cities in Babylonia, and this is according to his specific identification. Now, Nehardea was a very, as I mentioned before, Nehardea was a very ancient Jewish city and is known already by Josephus, mentioned by Josephus, as the city that the Jews used to donate the half a shekel to the yearly donation to the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. In later periods, we know that Rabbi Akiva visited the city of Nehardea in order to intercalate the year, le'aber et hashana. And I am sure that Rabbi Akiva did not immigrate to Nehardea for 10 Jewish people who lived there. It's probably, I guess, that Nehardea was had a very Jewish community, and that's one of the reasons why Rabbi Akiva visited the city in order to make sure that the intercalation of the year was indeed subject to the authority of the Palestinian sages of that time. And we have more, but that's a very, very long story. We have more traditions about Nehardia during the Tanaitic.
Can you describe the destruction of Nehardea in historical context?
Yes, Nehardea was destructed in the year 259 AD, according to Geonic traditions, which are considered to be very, very reliable, based on Professor Yeshayahu Gafni from Hebrew University and Professor Robert Brody, also from Hebrew University. And we indeed know that from archaeological evidence that indeed a figure named Papa Bar Natsur, which is also mentioned by Geonic, by Rav Shrira Gaon, in his famous epistle in the 10th century, this collaborates also the archaeological evidence of a figure named Papa Bar Natsur, or Netzer, who destructed with the Romans the Jewish city of Nehardea. But more than that is very, very difficult to say, because we hardly have any outside evidence about the city of Nehardea or Pumbedita in that period of time.
What can students of other fields in law and legal theory learn from your book? What can students of Islamic law, critical legal studies, or American constitutional law, for example, learn from Talmudic debates?
Many of the findings of legal philosophers dealing with legal philosophy nowadays could be traced, many of their conclusions about legal analogies, legal inference, could be traced back more than 1,005 years ago. For instance, legal analogies. Many, many scholars nowadays try to analyze different kinds of legal analogies in contemporary law. But in one of my studies published by Dine Israel, Faculty of Law in Tel Aviv University, I tried to argue that many of the legal analogies in contemporary law, mainly in the United States, has earlier roots, mainly from the Talmud itself, because the Talmud has, if you analyze legal analogies in the Babylonian Talmud, you may find that there are many kinds of legal analogies and inference in the Babylonian Talmud itself. And many of them are very, very similar to what we find nowadays in legal philosophies. And I think that the more you get to know the Talmud itself, its way of thinking, legal rulings, and so on, the easier it will be for legal scholars to understand how they functioned in ancient societies.
What does your book teach us about the nature and character of halachic decision-making and the system of halachic decision-making that existed among the Babylonian sages?
I would summarize the entire book in one or two sentences, short sentences. I would say that the law in Sasanian Babylonia depends more on the sages themselves and their own reasoning more than on earlier traditions. In other words, don't quote me, don't quote the Mishnah, don't quote the Baraita or earlier Tanaitic traditions or even local customs as the basis for law, because what really matters and was crucial is the way how the rabbi, the head of the academy or yeshiva in Hebrew, how he interpreted and applied the law in his own town. This is, I would say, one of the basic conclusions of the entire, and this has to do with the legal realism we just spoke about, because Jewish society was based more on the way the rabbis thought and ruled than on earlier traditions. And this has to do with the legal realism nowadays.
How were the decisions of the authorities examined in this book enforced? Who enforced them? What were the limits of the enforcement of the positions taken by the sages in Babylonia?
In Sasanian Babylonia, many of the rabbis saw themselves entitled to interpret earlier traditions in a very forced way. And their students could ask them, why are they interpreting the Mishnah or the Baraita or the biblical verse in a forced way? But at the end of the day, they never changed it. Why? Because the sage himself was considered as the authority, as the most important authority of law, and the way he interpreted the law and applied it to daily life, this is exactly what was important. So in other words, you never needed someone to enforce the law, because Rosh Yeshiva is considered as the most important authority of law, and he created either new halakha or interpreted the earlier traditions in the way he saw it should be interpreted. And this is exactly how the law was applied and created in Sasanian Babylonia.
What does your book teach us about the nature, character, and theory of arguments and argumentation?
First of all, many of the arguments are very different from one sage to the other sage. One sage's argument would be Palestinian traditions. He was influenced by Palestinian traditions. And in every case, the first question he asked himself is, what did Rabbi Yochanan in Tiberia, or what did Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi in Lod, southern part of Israel, of Palestine, what did he say on this topic? If he had his own opinion, so he himself, the Babylonian sage, saw himself as subject to their authority. Another sage who disagrees with him, in many cases, would base his ruling on his own reasoning. A third case or sage would base himself on a local custom or on Sasanian law, legal system or legal traditions. Every Amora, when you analyze their systematically, their contribution to the Talmud, you could see that every Amora has his own reasoning, his own basis for law. And in many cases, you could explain the many, many controversies between different colleagues in the Babylonian Talmud. For instance, between Rav and Shmuel, they have hundreds of disagreements between them in the Babylonian or in the Palestinian Talmud. There are many, many disagreements between Abaye and Rava in the Babylonian Talmud. What is the basis? I believe that when you have so many controversies, systematic controversies between Babylonian and Amoraim, it probably comes from a different background, different way of thinking, different methodology, and so on. And we have very interesting studies dealing and analyzing these controversies. For instance, Professor David Henschke, in one of his famous articles in Tarbitz during the 80s, I believe it was 81 or 82, he tried to show that in tens of examples of controversies between Abaye and Rava, they have different, they originate in their attitude towards the Mishnah as a legal authority. Abaye did not see the Mishnah as a legal source for daily life in every topic, legal topic. And in many cases, he even amended the Mishnah in order to apply the Mishnah to daily life in Sasanian Babylonia. In Rava's legal system or legal thinking, the Mishnah is the source for every halakha. And you study or learn new halakhot even from the style and wordings of the Mishnah. He applied the Mishnah, or he saw the Mishnah as Rabbi Akiva saw exactly the Torah. You learn new traditions or halakhic traditions from each and every word. You don't have extra wordings in the Mishnah. Every word has a meaning, and you must learn new halakhot from this wording. So you can see that by learning the different styles of the Amoraim, different methodologies, you can explain in a systematic way the basis for many of their controversies.
Can you describe any biographical information that is known about the figures you examine in this book? What historical details and agadic details exist about the specific sages?
In modern research, one should differentiate between agadic material and legal material in the Babylonian Talmud. In other words, agadic material might be a very, very problematic. They might be very problematic traditions, and unreliable that were probably created in the post-Talmudic period. And therefore, one should be very cautious in applying information from Agadic material to their daily life. Halakha and terminology is more historical, and therefore when you build a biography of the Babylonian Amoraim, the first thing you need to do is base yourself on legal traditions attributed to the sages and not Agadic material, which could be very, very problematic, historically speaking. Now, in many cases, we don't have too much. First of all, it should be noted that none of the rabbis in the Babylonian Talmud, even in general, we have about them outside sources outside the Babylonian Talmud, extra sources from the Babylonian Talmud. So our basic or the most important source is the Babylonian Talmud itself. And therefore, we apply and study the sages based on the Babylonian Talmud and the Palestinian, if they have any Palestinian traditions, parallels in the Yerushalmi, in the Palestinian. Now, the sages I have analyzed in the book are Rav Dimi Minehardia, Rav Svid Minehardia. Rav Dimi Minehardia, we have like 50 traditions about him. Ameimar, 200 traditions, but all other traditions about different sages are very few. And it's very, very hard to build a biography based on this material. I can say that based on the legal material attributed to Ameimar in the Babylonian Talmud, we get to see that he was a very, very bold figure. And in many cases, he rejected Tanaitic halakha in the Mishnah or in the Baraitot. He even rejected halakha in the Bible itself, or even rejected the halakha in his local town itself. And he says that explicitly. And this shows us the connection or the linkage between the sage's personality or bold personality and his literary contribution to the Babylonian Talmud. But I would say this is one of the greatest figures in the end, who lived in the end of the Babylonian, the Talmudic period, Babylonian Talmudic period, and he was the teacher of Rav Ashi, who is known to be one of the reductors of the Babylonian Talmud.
What social and political issues were the sages that you examine in this book coping with in their specific context? How does this background inform their perspectives and their methodology?
From a political point of view, I would say that Ameimar was a very authoritative, halachically speaking, authoritative figure, not only on Rav Ashi, but also on the exilarch known as Huna Bar Natan. Huna Bar Natan was probably the exilarch of his time. And we know about the different connections or the connections between Huna Bar Natan and the Sasanian king in the fifth century, based on the stories that Ameimar told Ameimar, and the way Ameimar interprets these stories in that time. But it's very hard to say, because the amount of information we have on the political situation in Babylonia of that time is very, very limited. And I would say that except for that specific information, we don't know too much about these figures. I would say that the more you study on Ameimar's legal rulings, you get to know more about Rav Ashi's legal rulings and traditions in the Babylonian Talmud, or as the reductor of the Babylonian Talmud. But that's basically what we know about their political and social information about the Talmud. I would also say that Ameimar was also very sensitive to social aspects, legal aspects in the Babylonian Talmud. As I mentioned before, Ameimar was willing to reject many of the halachot in the Mishnah or Baraitot, or even in the Bible, in a lenient way, in order to apply it in a better form in Machoza, in the Sasanian capital, for Jewish people in the Sasanian capital, or in Nehardea. He was very bold in that respect. But this is what we know from social and political background of that time, end of 4th century, beginning of 5th century in Sasanian.
What does your book teach us about the relationship between halakha and agadah?
My book analyzes mainly halakhic legal traditions. In my book, I hardly deal with analysis of agadic material, but the latest, say, a scholar who dealt with the linkage and a linkage between halakha and Agadah was Professor William Bacher, who died in 1914 in Budapest. He dealt with the linkage and the connection between halakha and Agadah, between the legal methodology and the way the same rabbis applied the Agadah in Sasanian Babylonia. And he found, he's the first and last scholar to find such a linkage between the way the sages interpret biblical and Tanaitic halakha, and the way the same scholars also interpreted the Midrashim, or the Tanaitic halakha in biblical verses in the Agadah, in the Agadic material. But as far as I know, no one has dealt with this issue or topic since the beginning of the 20th century.
Are there any references to the sages you examine in this book in the Jerusalem or Palestinian Talmud? If yes, what are the similarities and differences between the Yerushalmi and the Bavli? If not, why are certain figures absent from the Yerushalmi? Can you compare and contrast references to any of the figures in the Babylonian Talmud that you examine here to what they are depicted as saying in the Jerusalem Talmud?
The Babylonian sages that I deal with in this specific book are not mentioned in the Palestinian Talmud. Why? Because the Palestinian period, the Amoraic period in Palestine, ends, as I mentioned before, in the year 350, 370 AD, and so on. But these sages, their contribution and chronological period begin exactly at the end of the 4th century and during the beginning of the 5th century. In other words, the reason they are not mentioned in the Palestinian Talmud is simply attributed to that chronological rhythm. However, since then, I have dealt with the legal analysis of legal methodology of other Babylonian Amoraim, such as Shmuel and so on. And I found that there is a huge correlation between the legal rulings of these specific Amoraim and their material and the halachic material attributed to them in the Palestinian Talmud. This shows us, this is one of the reasons I believe that these attributions are indeed reliable, historically speaking. Why? Because if they indeed went through a reductional process, or even invented and attributed to these Amoraim by a very late editor who lived during the 6th or 7th centuries in Babylonia, how would you explain this correlation between the traditions attributed, for instance, to Shmuel in the Babylonian Talmud, his system, style, and methodology, and Shmuel's literature in the Palestinian Talmud? I just want to remind you that Shmuel is mentioned hundreds of times in the Palestinian Talmud. And when you analyze his contribution in the Babylonian Talmud and his contribution in the Palestinian Talmud, you find a very serious correlation between the entire legal system attributed to Shmuel. And this is one of the reasons it cannot be, in my opinion, an invasion, unreliable sources are invented by a late editor of the Babylonian Talmud. Why? Because I just want to remind you again that the Palestinian Talmud ends at the end of the 4th century, and it cannot be invented by someone who lived in the 6th or 7th centuries in Babylonia. In other words, it's not fictional. Shmuel is indeed, his legal system is indeed basically reliable.
What does your book teach us about the socio-historical evolution of the Talmud?
We get to see from recent studies that the Talmud itself was composed from different literary layers and not by one editor who lived during the 6th or 7th centuries. And I'll explain why. Because we see that the Talmud itself was, first of all, the different terms and legal methodology in many cases, they developed during the ages. A specific term has a specific meaning in a certain generation, but in later generations, that term expanded its meaning. And I see no reason why a late editor who lived during the 6th or 7th centuries would create such a phenomena in the Babylonian Talmud, other than a natural, like in our language, natural development of the language and the Talmudic terms. But not only that, we know that specific terms are attributed to specific generations in Babylonia, and these terms do not exist in later generations, only in specific generations. But later generations don't use that specific word for that meaning. They change the term to a different term or different Amoraic wordings in the Talmud. And this also provides us with a general picture of how the Talmud was created layer after layer during the Talmudic period. This is the testimony of Rav Shlomo Hagaon about the composition of the Babylonian Talmud. And this is also collaborated by the different studies by Professor Avraham Weiss during the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And also by Professor Avinoam Cohen and Professor Richard Kalmin, who dealt with the terminology and its development during the ages.
In what ways, if any, does your personal identity and life context give you unique insights as you examine the texts and sages that you study in this book? What does it mean to you to study the Talmud as an Israeli in the 21st century?
First of all, I would say that learning Talmud in such a way brings you to be very, very critical about Jewish traditions in general. Why? Because when you get to know the sages, their ways of rulings, in a different way, you get a different picture from the way the sages in Middle Ages, Harishonim and Achronim, interpret the Babylonian Talmud. And you have a tool in which you are able to analyze and study the Talmud independently from the parshanut, the interpretive traditions of the rabbis in Middle Ages and in modern times, from the different way of analyzing the tradition. And this makes you be very, very critical. Many Talmidei Yeshivot, or I would say students who study at the Yeshivot in Israel and so on, when they come over to our department, many of it influences their way of thinking and studying the Talmud. And unfortunately, a few of them, my students, even became non-religious during the years. Why? Because when you study the Talmud in this critical way, this is one of the reasons why you become very critical about Judaism in general. I would say that also, by analyzing the Talmud, you have a new way of interpreting the Talmud. And this itself creates a new scientific way of interpreting the Talmud as a research method. And it's a new way of understanding the Talmud. But not only that, you get to know more about the sages, their historical background, their legal rulings, the different terminology of the Talmud. And many of my students, who are also rabbis in different academies in Israel are enriched by this information, and they keep telling me all the time how they never studied in such a way in the yeshiva. And all of a sudden, they get to understand in a new way what is the different meanings of similar terms in the Talmud, the historical background, the study school, the yeshivot, and the different terms of the way the rabbis used to study in the yeshivot, and so on.
On page 167, there is a passage where you quote Israeli High Court Justice Aharon Barak's words in the context of interpreting the jurisprudence of Rabbi Zvi of Nehar Dea. You quote Aharon Barak to the effect that, quote unquote, a word in a statute is a creature of its environment. Its character is a function of its context. What are the interconnections between this perspective of Chief Justice Barak and Rabbi Zvid of Nehar Dea's worldview?
Aharon Barak published a very, very important book and called Interpretation in Law. And he tries to analyze the different interpretations and application of the law by judges in contemporary legal systems in Israel. And there he claims that when you interpret a statute or a specific law, you must take into consideration the context in which this statute or law was created. In other words, when you interpret the law or statute, you must explain it based on its historical or legal context. And when you apply this while analyzing Rav Zvid's interpretation to earlier Amoraic or Tanaitic traditions, you find something which is very similar. Rav Zvid Nehar Dea, from the city of Nehar Dea, he was a Maimar's rabbi or teacher. And he used, when every time he heard a first forced interpretation to a Tanaitic or a more earlier Amoraic halacha, he used to criticize and reject this interpretation in cases where this interpretation that cannot be applied based on the historical, on the meaning, the contextual meaning of that specific law. Therefore, when a Maimar or some other scholar interpreted the Mishnah, and this interpretation cannot be applied or explained to the Mishnah based on its contextual meaning, he used to reject this meaning. How did he create the contextual meaning? Because what Rav Zvid Nehar Dea usually does is he quotes the end of that tradition in the Baraitot, in the parallel Tanaitic traditions, in the Tosefta. And he demanded that every interpretation to a Mishnah should be also logical in its contextual meaning in the Tosefta. Because as I mentioned before, the Baraitot were left outside by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the prince. And Rav Zvid Nehar Dea used to quote them in order to analyze and he used to be very critical about interpretations of different sages who could not be explained also based on the contextual meaning of the text.
What is the relevance of your book in the year 2023? In what ways, if at all, can it speak to current issues? In what ways can it speak to contemporary Israelis?
First of all, the Talmud, we should know, it should be noted that the Talmud is a canonical text nowadays, and it has an influence on all religious fields in contemporary halachic system, in all Jewish, all Orthodox communities. Now, the more you get to understand how the law was created in the Talmud itself, the more you get to understand how Judaism was functioning in ancient societies in comparison to nowadays. And this is one of the implications I mentioned before about being critical about Jewish traditions, because then you get to know how the law was created in contrary to nowadays. That's the first thing. The second thing is, when you analyze the rabbi's contribution and each and every sage's different contribution, different way of thinking, different world, different methods of interpretation, and so on, you have a new way of a scientific understanding of the Talmud. In other words, one should not explain the Talmud based on Middle Ages rabbis in Middle Ages literature. And in order to understand the Talmud in a better way, you must get to know their legal, reasoning and legal methodology, and only after knowing this, you may come back to this or that specific sugya and interpret it in its original meaning. So, in other words, getting to know the Talmud and how the Talmud was created, that is the basis for Judaism nowadays. And the more you get to know about the Talmud, the more you get to know or being critical about nowadays rulings in contemporary legal system. I think that's the reason why it has its impact on Jewish Orthodox halakha nowadays. The second thing is, as also I mentioned before, is the scientific study of the Babylonian Talmud. There are many, many, all kinds of intuitions and all kinds of problems explaining the rabbi's rulings and interpretations and so on. And by getting to know his specific legal system, this allows you to offer a new explanation for their legal methodology and rulings in the Babylonian Talmud.
What does your book teach us about the relationship between social customs and halakha in the context of the sages in Babylonian communities under the Sasanian Empire?
I could say this, that in recent years, not specifically in the book, but in recent years, I have found something very interesting, which really puzzled me. Authority was attributed only to specific sages in Sasanian Babylonia. Not every sage was considered as an authoritative source. In other words, only Rashei Yeshivot, meaning head of academy schools in Sasanian or Babylonia, were considered as authoritative source, as binding source in the eyes of later sages. In other words, if a later sage ruled or had a custom, legal custom in his town, which contradicts earlier sages, one of the sages that I mentioned before, he was immediately refuted by one of his colleagues and asked, why did he contradict the earlier sage's ruling or statement before him? Then, if he did not have or explain his own reasoning and why he contradicted the earlier sage's halakha, opinion was rejected, exactly like in regard to Tanaitic Palestinian halakha. Therefore, when he was refuted by one of his colleagues, he always tried to explain why he did so, because the situation here is very different. Or sometimes he would explain and say that he wasn't aware of this specific legislations before him, and so on and so on. But he was never able to reject or contribute explicitly the authority of the earlier Amoraic source. In other words, out of 800 Amoraim in the Babylonian Talmud, we know that only about 20 of them were considered as halachically binding authoritative sources in Sasanian Babylon. This shows us how along the Talmudic period, we see how the rulings or the rules for halakha was functioning and established during the Talmudic period until the beginning of Middle Ages.
What suggestions do you have for topics that students who read your book might consider examining after engaging with your study? What are some topics in Talmudic research that your book would encourage a new generation of academic Talmud scholars to pursue?
First of all, this question I deal mainly during my work here at the Department of Talmud at Bar Ilan University with my students. Many of them, specifically in recent years, deal with trying to analyze controversies between Rav and Shmuel, between Rav Huna and Rav Chusta, Rav Chisda, main great authorities, contemporary authorities in Sasanian Babylonia. And by doing so, they are able, once, b'pam harishona b'mechkar, first time in modern scholarship, we are able to try and explain in a systematic way how every sage thought in a different way and applied a different kind of methodology, and why it usually disagreed so many times in the Babylonian parallels in the Palestinian. This is one field which I think is very, very important, and there's so much work to do in the field. The second field, I would say, is Talmudic terminology. Terminology is not just a specific literary term, but there's a whole way of thinking and methodology hiding behind this specific term. And therefore, by explaining similar terms and trying to explain why the editor of the, in this case, used a specific term, and why something which seems to be very similar refutation, questions, question, answer, and so on, why is it mentioned in a different term in the Babylonian Talmud? This also is a very important study of the Babylonian Talmud, because we don't have nowadays a Milon dictionary of the terms in Babylonia, a dictionary of the Amoraic terms, but a dictionary of the way of thinking hidden behind these specific terms and their development during the Talmudic period. This explains to us, it helps us in learning the Talmud itself.
As we bring our dialogue today to a close, can you tell us about the relationship between this book and your later and recent scholarship?
In recent years, I continued the research on the legal methodology and more of more Amoraim. And I was able to see in recent years how every Amora indeed had a different literary contribution and different methodology in the Babylonian Talmud. Then I went further and examined the in the Babylonian Talmud, and I was able to see how different or similar terms have different meanings in Sugya, and how this has its implication of the understanding of these passages. Not only that, these two studies have different implications on other fields of Halakha. For instance, I was able to trace and analyze the question of legal pluralism in the Babylonian Talmud. In other words, by analyzing study methods and Talmudic terminology, I was able to see, and I never planned it. This is one of the implications of this study, is that I found that the Talmud was so pluralistic as people or scholars claim of the Babylonian Talmud. For instance, as I mentioned, we have about 20 sages in Sasanian Babylonia that they use as authoritative sources, and one could not reject or negate. Later sages always saw themselves subject to their own authority, and if they contradicted these traditions, they were immediately refuted by their contemporaries. So therefore, I'm not so sure that the Talmud was indeed so pluralistic and tolerant towards diverse in the Babylonian Talmud. It was, but not in the way they are depicted in recent studies. also say that these conclusions also showed more and more the dating of the Stamaitic period, meaning the anonymous voice, anonymous literary strata of the Babylonian Talmud seems to be poetic and not at the same time. Why? Because you see more and more that the same term might have a different and sometimes opposing meaning in the Aboret and in the Stamaitic period. In other words, it seems more likely that the specific term had a development during the ages and until it had a new meaning or developed to an opposing meaning in the late stratum of the Talmud. I don't believe that who used the term in exactly an opposite way of understanding lived at the same time where the Amoraim used to interpret term in an opposing meaning. Ze lo yechol liot, it can't be that two figures lived exactly at the same time period. This will hopefully will be in three separate studies. One in Sidra, the Journal for the Study of Literature, by our Department of Talmud, as was published by the Journal of Jewish Studies by Oxford University, 19. And a third study will be on this in next year by the Studies Quarterly by Stanford University. And I believe that I prepare hundreds of sugiyot where you can find the different G's and different meanings of the term, sometimes opposing terms, in these studies. So whoever wants to broaden and try to explain and try to understand the implications of such studies of legal methods of the Babylonian Amoraim Talmudic methodology are obviously invited to read three of my recent studies.
As we end our dialogue today, I am signing off by reminding you that I'm Ari Barbalat, your host today on the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I've been in dialogue with Dr. Barak Cohen. He is a senior lecturer of Talmudic literature at Bar-Ilan University. We have been discussing his book, The Legal Methodology of Late Nehardian Sages in Sasanian Babylonia, published in Leiden, Netherlands by Brill Publishers, 2011. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure and my honor. Thank you.